over. Avasarala leaned forward, tapping her hand terminal twice to add a layer of encryption. The red icon went green. "Go ahead," she said. "It's from Ganymede, miss. You have a standing order on James Holden." "Yes?" "He's on the move. He made an apparent rendezvous with a local scientist, Praxidiki Meng." "What's Meng?" "In Atlanta," Amir transitioned smoothly to a different file. "Botanist, miss. Emigrated to Ganymede with his family when he was a child, schooled there. Specializes in partial pressure low-light soybean strains. Divorced, one child, no known connections to the OPA or any established political party." "Go ahead." "Holden, Meng, and Burton have left their ship. They're armed, and they've made contact with a small group of private security types, Pinkwater." "How many?" "The on-site analyst doesn't say, miss. A small force. Should I query?" "What lag are we at?" Amir's brown-black eyes flickered. 41 minutes, 8 seconds, miss." "Hold the query. If I have anything else, I can send them together. The on-site analyst reports that Holden negotiated with the private security. Either a last-minute renegotiation or else the whole meeting was extemporaneous. It appears they reached some agreement. The full group proceeded to an unused corridor complex and forced entry."
"A what?"
"Disused access door, miss."
"What the fuck is that supposed to mean? How big is it? Where is it?
Should I query?"
"You should go to Ganymede and kick this sorry excuse for an on-site analyst in the balls. Add a clarification request."
"Yes, miss," Amir said with a ghost of a smile. Then suddenly he frowned. "An update, one moment. So, the OPA had something on Ganymede. Maybe something they'd put there. Maybe something they'd found. Either way, this mysterious door made things a degree more interesting." While Amir read through and digested the new update, Avasarala scratched the back of her hand and reevaluated her position. She'd thought Holden was there as an observer. Forward intelligence. That might be wrong. If he'd gone to meet with this Praxidiki Meng, this utterly under-the-radar botanist, the OPA might already know quite a bit about Bobby Draper's monster. Add the fact that Holden's boss had the only known sample of the protomolecule, and a narrative about the Ganymede collapse began to take shape. There were holes in it, though. If the OPA had been playing with the protomolecule, there'd been no sign of it. And Fred Johnson's psychological profile didn't match with terrorist attacks. Johnson was old school, and the monster attack was decidedly new.
"There's been a firefight, miss. Holden and his people have met armed resistance. They've set a perimeter. The on-site analyst can't approach."
"Resistance? I thought this was supposed to be unused. Who the fuck are they shooting at?"
"Shall I query?"
"God damn it!" 40 light minutes away, something important was going on, and she was here, in a bedroom that wasn't hers, trying to make sense of it by pressing her ear to the wall. The frustration was a physical sensation. It felt like being crushed. 40 minutes out, 40 minutes back. Whatever she said, whatever order she gave, it would get there almost an hour and a half behind what was clearly a rapidly changing situation.
"Pull him in," she said. "Holden, Burton. They're Pinkwater friends, and this mysterious botanist. Bring them all in, now."
Amir in Atlanta paused.
"If they're in a firefight, miss, then send in the dogs, break up the fight, and take them in. We're past surveillance. Get it done."
"Yes, miss."
"Contact me as soon as it's done."
"Yes, miss." She watched Amir's face as he framed the order, confirmed it, sent it out. She could practically imagine the screen, the strokes of his fingers. She willed him to go faster, to press her intent out past the speed of light and get the damn thing done. Orders out. As soon as I hear from the on-site analyst, I'll reach you. I'll be here. If I don't take the connection, try again until I wake up. She dropped the link and sat back. Her brain felt like a swarm of bees. James Holden had changed the game again. The boy had a talent for that, but that in itself made him a known quantity. This other one, this Hmong, had come from her blind side. The man might be a mole, or a volunteer, or a stalking goat sent to lead the OPA into a trap. She considered turning off the light, trying to sleep, then abandoned it as a bad bet. Instead, she set up a connection with the UN's intelligence research database. It was an hour and a half at earliest before she'd hear anything more. In the meantime, she wanted to know who Praxidiki Hmong was and why he mattered. Chapter 19. Holden. Naomi, prep the ship. We have to get off this moon. We have to do it right now. All around Holden, the black filament spread, a dark spider's web with him at the center. He was on Eros again. He was seeing thousands of bodies turning into something else. He thought he'd made it off, but Eros just kept coming. He and Miller had gotten out, but it got Miller anyway. Now, it was back for him. "What's the matter, Jim?" Naomi said from the distance of the suit radio. "Jim, prep the ship."
"It's the stuff," Amos said. He was talking to Naomi. "Like from Eros."
"Jesus, they..." Holden managed to gasp out before the fear welled up in his mind, robbing him of speech. His heart banged against his ribs like it wanted out, and he had to check the oxygen levels on his HUD. It felt like there wasn't enough air in the room. Out of the corner of his eye, something appeared to scuttle up the wall like a disembodied hand, leaving a trail of brown slime in its wake. When Holden spun and pointed his assault rifle at it, it resolved into a bloodstain below a discolored patch of ice. Amos moved toward him, a worried look on his broad face. Holden waved him off, then set the butt of his rifle on the ground and leaned on a nearby crate to catch his breath.
"We should probably move out," Wendell said.
He and Paula were helping hold up the man who'd been gutshot. The injured man was having trouble breathing. A small, red bubble of blood had formed in his left nostril, and it inflated and deflated with each ragged gasp the man took. "Jim," Naomi said in his ear, her voice soft. "Jim, I saw it through Amos's suit cam, and I know what it means. I'm getting the ship ready. That encrypted local traffic? It's dropped way off. I think everyone's gone."
"Everyone's gone," Holden echoed.
The diminished remains of his Pinkwater team were staring at him, the concern on their faces shifting to fear, his own terror infecting them even though they had no idea what the filament meant. They wanted him to do something, and he knew he had to, but he couldn't quite think what it was. The black web filled his head with flashing images, running too quickly to make sense, like video played at high speed. Julie Mao in her shower, the black threads surrounding her, her body twisted into a nightmare. Bodies scattered across the floor of a radiation chamber. The zombie-like infected staggering off the trams in Eros, vomiting brown bile on everyone around them, even a drop of the goo a death sentence. Video captures of the horror show Eros had become. A torso stripped to a ribcage and one arm dragging itself through the protomolecule landscape on some unknowable mission.
"Cap,"
Amos said, then moved over to touch Holden's arm. Holden yanked away, almost falling over in the process. He swallowed the thick, lemony-flavored saliva building up in his throat and said, "Okay, I'm here. Let's go. Naomi, call Alex. We need the Rossi." Naomi didn't answer for a moment, then said, "What about the block? Right fucking now, Naomi." Holden yelled, "Right fucking now. Call Alex right now." She didn't reply, but the gutshot man took one final ragged breath and then collapsed, nearly dragging the wounded Wendell to the floor with him. "We have to go," Holden said to Wendell, meaning, "We can't help him. If we stay, we all die." Wendell nodded, but went to one knee and began taking the man's light armor off, not understanding. Amos pulled the emergency med kit off his harness and dropped down next to Wendell to begin working on the wounded man while Paula watched, her face pale. "Have to go," Holden said again, wanting to grab Amos and shake him until he understood. "Amos, stop. We have to go right now. Eros, cab," Amos interrupted. "All due respect, but this ain't Eros." He took a syringe from the med kit and gave the downed man an injection. "No radiation rooms, no zombies puking goo, just that broken box, a whole lot of dead guys, and these black threads. We don't know what the fuck it is, but it ain't Eros. And we ain't leaving this guy behind." The small, rational part of Holden's mind knew Amos was right. And more than that, the person Holden wanted to believe he still was would never consider leaving even a complete stranger behind, much less a guy who'd taken a wound for him. He forced himself to take three deep, slow breaths. Prax knelt by Amos's side, holding the medkit. "Naomi," Holden said, meaning to apologize for yelling at her. "Alex is on his way," she replied, her voice tight but not accusing. "He's a few hours out. Running the blockade won't be easy, but he thinks he's got an angle. Where is he putting down?" Holden found himself answering before he realized he'd made the decision. "Tell him to land in the somnambulist's berth. I'm giving her to someone. Meet us outside the airlock when we get there." He pulled the mag key for the somnambulist out of a pocket on his harness and tossed it to Wendell. "This will get you on the ship you're taking. Consider it a down payment for services rendered." Wendell nodded and tucked the key away, then went back to his injured man. The man appeared to be breathing. "Can he be carried?" Holden asked Amos, proud of how steady his voice sounded again, trying not to think about the fact that he would have left the man to die a minute before.
"No choice, Cap."
"Then somebody pick him up," Holden said. "No, not you, Amos. I need you back on point."
"I got him," Wendell said. "I can't shoot for shit with his hand busted."
"Prax, help him," Holden said. "We're getting the hell out of here." They moved as quickly as injured people could back through the base, back past the men and women they'd killed getting in, and, more frighteningly, the ones they hadn't. Back past Katoa's small, still corpse. Prex's gaze drifted toward the body, but Holden grabbed his jacket and shoved him toward the hatch. "It's still not May," he said. "Slow us down and I leave you." The threat made him feel like an ass the moment it left his lips. But it wasn't idle. Finding the scientist's lost little girl had stopped being the priority the instant they found the black filaments. And, as long as he was being honest with himself, leaving the scientist behind would mean not being there when they found his daughter, twisted into a monster by the protomolecule, brown goo leaking from orifices she hadn't been born with, the black threads crawling from her mouth and eyes. The older Pinkwater man, who'd been covering their exit, rushed over to help carry the injured man without being asked. Prax handed the wounded man off to him without a word, and then slid in place behind Paula as she scanned the hallways ahead with her machine pistol. Corridors that had seemed boring on the trip in took on a sinister feel on the way back out. The frosted texture that had reminded Holden of spider webs when he'd come in now looked like the veins of some living thing. Their pulsing had to be caused by adrenaline making his eyes twitch. 8 rems burning off Jupiter onto the surface of Ganymede, even with the magnetosphere, 8 rems a day. How quickly would the protomolecule grow here, with Jupiter endlessly supplying the energy? Eros had become something frighteningly powerful once the protomolecule had taken hold. Something that could accelerate at incredible speeds without inertia. Something that could, if the reports were right, change the very atmosphere and chemical composition of Venus. And that was with just over 1 million human hosts and 1,000 trillion tons of rocky mass to work with at the beginning. Ganymede had 10 times as many humans, and many orders of magnitude more mass than Eros. What could the ancient alien weapon do with such bounty? Amos threw open the last hatch to the shadow base, and the crew was back in the higher traffic tunnels of Ganymede. Holden didn't see anyone acting infected. No mindless zombies staggering through the corridors, no brown vomit coating the walls and floor, filled with the alien virus looking for a host. No protogen-hired thugs shepherding people into the kill zone. Protogen is gone. An itch at the back of his mind that Holden hadn't even been aware of pushed its way to the front. Protogen was gone. Holden had helped bring them down. He'd been in the room when the architect of the Eros experiment died. The Martian fleet had nuked Phoebe into a thin gas that was sucked into Saturn's massive gravity. Eros had crashed into the acidic and autoclave-hot atmosphere of Venus, where no human ships could go. Holden himself had taken Protogen's only sample of the protomolecule away from them. So who had brought the protomolecule to Ganymede? He'd given the sample to Fred Johnson as leverage to be used in the peace talks. The Outer Planets Alliance had gotten a lot of concessions in the chaos that followed the brief Inner Planets War, but not everything they'd wanted. The Inner Planets fleets in orbit around Ganymede were proof of that. Fred had the only sample of the protomolecule left in the solar system, because Holden had given it to him. "It was Fred," he said out loud without realizing it. "What was Fred?" Naomi asked. "This. What's happening here? He did this." "No," Naomi said. "To drive the inner planets out, to test some kind of super weapon, something. But he did this." "No," Naomi said again. "We don't know that." The air in the corridor grew smoky. The nauseating scent of burning hair and flesh choking off Holden's reply. Amos held up a hand to halt the group, and the Pinkwater people stopped and took up defensive positions. Amos moved up the corridor to the junction and looked off to his left for several moments.
"Something bad happened here," he finally said. "I've got 6 dead. More than that celebrating."
"Are they armed?" Holden asked.
"Oh, yeah."
The Holden who would have tried to talk his way by them, the Holden who Naomi liked and wanted back, barely put up a struggle when he said,
"Get us past them."
Amos leaned out around the corner and fired off a long burst from his auto shotgun.
"Go,"
he said when the echoes of the gunshots had faded away. The Pinkwater people picked up their wounded and hurried up the corridor and beyond the battle. Prax jogged along close behind, head down and thin arms pumping. Holden followed, a glance showing him dead bodies on fire at the center of a wide hallway. Burning them
had to be a message. It wasn't quite bad enough yet for them to be eating each other, was it? There were a few bodies lying outside the fire, bleeding out on the corrugated metal floors. Holden couldn't tell if they were Amos's handiwork. The old Holden would have asked. The new one didn't. Naomi, he said, wanting to hear her voice. I'm here. We're seeing trouble out here. Is it? He heard the dread in her voice. No, not the protomolecule. But the locals may be bad enough. Seal up the locks, Holden told her, the words coming to him without thought. Warm up the reactor. If something happens to us, leave and rendezvous with Alex. Don't go to Tycho. Jim, she said, I don't go to Tycho. Fred did this. Don't go back to him. No, she said, her new mantra. If we aren't there in half an hour, go. That's an order, Exo. At least she would get away, Holden told himself. No matter what happened on Ganymede, at least Naomi would make it out alive. A vision of the nightmare Julie, dead in her shower but with Naomi's face, flashed in his mind. He didn't expect the little yelp of grief that escaped him. Amos turned and looked back at him, but Holden waved him on without a word. Fred had done this. And if Fred had, then Holden had too. Holden had spent a year playing enforcer to Fred's politician. He'd hunted ships and killed them for Fred's grand OPA government experiment. He'd changed the man he'd been into the man he was now, because some part of him believed in Fred's dream of the liberated and self-governed outer planets. And Fred had secretly been planning this. Holden thought of all the things he'd put off so that he could help Fred build his new solar system order. He'd never taken Naomi to meet his family back on Earth. Not that Naomi herself could have ever gone to Earth, but he could have flown his family up to Luna to meet her. Father Tom would have resisted. He hated travel. But Holden had no doubt that in the end, he would have gotten them all to come meet her once he explained how important she'd become to him. And meeting Prax, seeing his need to find his daughter, made Holden realize how badly he wanted to know what that was like. To experience that sort of hunger for the presence of another human being. To present another generation to his parents. To show them that all the effort and energy they had put into him had paid off. That he was passing it along. He wanted, almost more than he'd wanted anything before, to see the looks on their faces when he showed them a child. His child. Naomi's child. Fred had taken that from him. First by wasting his time as the OPA's leg breaker, and now by this betrayal. Holden swore to himself that if he made it off Ganymede, Fred would pay for all of it. Amos halted the group again, and Holden noticed that they were back at the port. He shook himself out of his reverie. He didn't remember how they'd gotten there. Looks clear, Amos said. Naomi, Holden said. What does it look like around the ship? Looks clear here, she said, but Alex is worried that... Her voice was cut off by an electronic squeal. Naomi? Naomi! Holden yelled. But there was no response. To Amos, he said, Go, double time it to the ship. Amos and the Pinkwater people ran toward the docks as quickly as their injured bodies and the unconscious teammate would let them. Holden brought up the rear, shouldering his assault rifle and flicking off the safety as he ran. They ran through the twisting corridors of the port sector, Amos scattering pedestrians with loud shouts and the unspoken threat of his shotgun. An old woman in a hijab scurried away before them like a leaf driven before a storm. She was dead already. If the protomolecule was loose, everyone Holden passed was dead already. Santa Chai and Melissa Supateaporn, and all the people they'd come to Ganymede to save. The rioters and killers who'd been normal citizens of the station before their social ecosystem collapsed. If the protomolecule was loose, all of them were as good as dead. So, why hadn't it happened? Holden pushed the thought aside. Later, if there was a later, he could worry about it. Someone shouted at Amos, and Amos fired his shotgun into the ceiling once. If port security still existed outside of the vultures trying to take a cut of every incoming shipment, they didn't try to stop them. The outer airlock door of the somnambulist was closed when they reached it. Naomi, you there? Holden asked, fumbling in his pockets for the swipe card. She didn't reply, and it took him a moment to remember he'd given the card to Wendell. Wendell, open the door for us. The Pinkwater leader didn't reply. Wendell, Holden started, then stopped when he saw that Wendell was staring wide-eyed at something behind him. Holden turned to look and saw five men, Earthers all of them, in plain gray armor without insignias. All were armed with large bore weapons. No, Holden thought, and brought his gun up and across them in a full auto sweep. Three of the five men dropped, their armor blooming red. The new Holden rejoiced. The old was quiet. It didn't matter who these men were. Station security, or interplanet military, or just leftover mercenaries from the now destroyed shadow base. He'd kill them all before he let them stop him from getting his crew off this infected moon. He never saw who fired the shot that took his leg out from under him. One second he was standing, emptying the magazine of his assault rifle into the gray armored fire team, and the next, a sledgehammer blow hit the armor on his right thigh, knocking him off his feet. As he fell, he saw the two remaining gray-armored soldiers go down as Amos's auto-shotgun unloaded in a single, long roar. Holden rolled to his side, looking to see if anyone else was hurt, and saw that the five on his side had been only half of the enemy team. The Pinkwater people were raising their hands and dropping their weapons as five more gray-armored soldiers came down the corridor from behind. Amos never saw them. He dropped the expended magazine from his auto shotgun and was pulling a new one off his harness when one of the mercenaries aimed a large weapon at the back of his head and pulled the trigger. Amos's helmet flew off, and he was slapped forward onto the corrugated metal decking with a wet crunch. Blood splashed across the floor where he hit it. Holden tried to get a new magazine into his assault rifle, but his hands wouldn't cooperate, and before he could reload his gun, one of the soldiers had crossed the distance and kicked the rifle away from him. Holden had time to see the still-standing members of his Pinkwater team disappear into black bags before one came down over his own head and plunged him into darkness. Chapter 20. Bobby. The Martian delegation had been given a suite of offices in the UN building for their own use. The furniture was all real wood. The paintings on the walls were originals and not prints. The carpet smelled new. Bobby thought that either everyone in the UN campus lived like a king, or they were just going out of their way to impress the Martians. Thorson had called her a few hours after she'd left her run-in with Avasarala at the bar and had demanded that she meet with him the next day. Now she waited in the lobby of their temporary office suite, sitting in a bergère-style chair with green velvet cushions and a cherry wood frame that would have cost her 2 years' salary on Mars.
A screen set into the wall across from her played a news channel with the sound muted. It turned the program into a confusing and occasionally macabre slideshow of images. Two talking heads sitting at a desk in a blue room, a large building on fire. A woman walking down a long white hallway while gesturing animatedly to both sides. A UN battleship parked at an orbital station with severe damage scarring its flank. A red-faced man talking directly into the camera against the backdrop of a flag Bobby didn't recognize. It all meant something and nothing at the same time. A few hours before, this would have frustrated Bobby. She would have felt compelled to go find the remote and turn the sound up to add context to the information being thrown at her. Now, she just let the images flow around her like canal water past a rock. A young man she'd seen a few times on the Daejeon, but had never actually met, hurried through the lobby, tapping furiously on his terminal. When he was halfway across the room, he said, "He's ready for you." It took Bobby a moment to realize the young man had been talking to her. Apparently, her stock had fallen far enough that she no longer warranted face-to-face delivery of information. More meaningless data. More water flowing past her. She pushed herself to her feet with a grunt. Her hours-long walk at 1G the previous day had taken more out of her than she'd realized. She was vaguely surprised to find that Thorson's office was one of the smallest in the suite. That meant that either he didn't care about the unspoken status conferred through office size, or he was actually the least important member of the delegation to still rate a private workspace. She felt no compulsion to figure out which. Thorson did not react to her arrival, his head bent over his desk terminal. Bobby didn't care about being ignored, or about the lesson he was trying to teach her with it. The size of the office meant that Thorson had no chair for guests, and the ache in her legs was sufficiently distracting. "I may have overreacted earlier," he finally said. "Oh?" Bobby replied, thinking about where she might find more of that soy milk tea. Thorson looked up at her. His face was trying its mummified remains version of a warm smile. "Let me be clear. There's no doubt that you damaged our credibility with your outburst. But as Martins points out, that is largely my fault for not fully understanding the extent of your trauma." "Ah," Bobby said. There was a framed photograph on the wall behind Thorson of a city with a tall metal structure in the foreground. It looked like an archaic rocket gantry. The caption read, "Paris." "So, instead of sending you home, I will be keeping you on staff here. You will be given an opportunity to repair the damage you've done." "Why?" Bobby said, looking Thorson in the eye for the first time since coming in. "Am I here?" Thorson's hint of a smile disappeared and was replaced by an equally understated frown. "Excuse me?" "Why am I here?" she repeated, thinking past the disciplinary board, thinking of how hard it would be to get reassigned to Ganymede if Thorson didn't send her back to Mars. If he didn't, would she be allowed to resign? Just leave the Corps and buy her own ticket? The thought of no longer being a Marine made her sad, the first really strong feeling she'd had in a while. "Why are you—" Thorson started, but Bobby cut him off. "Not to talk about the monster, apparently. Honestly, if I'm just here as a showpiece, I think I'd rather be sent home. I have some things I could be doing." "You," Thorson said, his voice getting tighter, "are here to do exactly what I say for you to do, and exactly when I say it. Is that understood, soldier?" "Yeah," Bobby said, feeling the water slide past her. She was a stone. It moved her not at all.
I have to go now. She turned and walked away, Thorson not managing to get a last word out before she left. As she moved through the suite toward the exit, she saw Martins pouring powdered creamer into a cup of coffee in the small kitchen area. He spotted her at the same time. Bobby, he said. He'd gotten a lot more familiar with her over the last few days. Normally, she'd have assumed it was a build-up to romantic or sexual overtures. With Martins, she was pretty sure it was just another tool in his how-to-fix-broken Marines toolkit. Captain, she said. She stopped. She felt the front door tugging at her with a sort of psychic gravity, but Martins had never been anything but good to her. And she had a strange premonition that she was never going to see any of these people again. She held out her hand to him, and when he took it, she said, I'm leaving. You won't have to waste your time with me anymore. He smiled his sad smile at her. In spite of the fact that I don't actually feel like I've accomplished anything, I don't feel like I wasted my time. Do we part friends? She started, then had to stop and swallow a lump in her throat. I hope this didn't wreck your career or anything. I'm not worried about it, he said to her back. She was already walking out the door. She didn't turn around. In the hallway, Bobby pulled out her terminal and called the number Avasarala had given her. It immediately went to voicemail. Okay, she said. I'll take that job. There was something liberating and terrifying about the first day on a new job. In any new assignment, Bobby had always had the unsettling feeling that she was in over her head, that she wouldn't know how to do any of the things they would ask her to do, that she would dress wrong or say the wrong thing, or that everyone would hate her. But no matter how strong that feeling was, it was overshadowed by the sense that with a new job came the chance to totally recreate herself in whatever image she chose, that, at least for a little while, her options were infinite. Even waiting for Avasarala finally to notice her couldn't fully dampen that feeling. Standing in Avasarala's office reinforced Bobby's impression that the Martian suite was intended to impress. The deputy secretary was important enough to get Bobby transferred out of Thorson's command and into a liaison role for the UN with a single phone call. And yet, her office had cheap carpet that smelled unpleasantly of stale tobacco smoke. Her desk was old and scuffed, no cherry wood chairs here. The only things that looked lovingly tended in the room were the fresh flowers and the Buddha shrine. Avasarala radiated weariness. There were dark circles under her eyes that hadn't been there during their official meetings and hadn't been visible in the dim lights of the bar where she'd made her offer. Sitting behind her giant desk in a bright blue sari, she looked very small, like a child pretending to be a grown-up. Only the gray hair and crow's feet ruined the illusion. Bobby suddenly pictured her instead as a cranky doll, complaining as children moved her arms and legs and forced her to go to tea parties with stuffed animals. The thought made her cheeks ache from restraining the grin. Avasarala tapped at a terminal on her desk and grunted with irritation. No more tea for you, Grandma Dolly. You've had enough, Bobby thought, then stifled a laugh.
Sorin, you've moved my fucking files again. I can't find a goddamn thing anymore.
The stiff young man who'd brought Bobby into the office and then sort of melted into the background cleared his throat. It made Bobby jump. He was closer behind her than she'd realized.
Ma'am, you asked me to move a few of the...
Yes, yes, Avasarala interrupted, tapping harder on the terminal screen, as if that would make the device understand what she wanted. Something about that made Bobby think of people who started talking louder when trying to communicate with someone who spoke a different language.
Okay, there they are.
Avasarala said with irritation. Why you'd put them... She tapped a few more times, and Bobby's terminal chimed. That, she said, is the report and all of my notes on the Ganymede situation. Read them, today. I may have an update later once I've had a little polite questioning done. Bobby pulled out her terminal and scrolled quickly through the documents she'd just been sent. It went on and on for hundreds of pages. Her first thought was, did she really mean read all of this today? This was quickly followed by, did she really just hand me everything she knows? It made her own government's recent treatment of her look even worse. It won't take you long, her new boss continued. There's almost nothing there. Lots of bullshit by overpaid consultants who think they can hide the fact that they don't actually know anything by talking twice as long. Bobby nodded, but the feeling of being in over her head had started to outcompete her excitement at the new opportunity. Ma'am, is Sergeant Draper cleared to access? Soren said, yes, I just cleared her. Bobby, you're cleared. Avasarala said, right over the top of him. Stop busting my balls, Soren. I'm out of tea. Bobby made a conscious effort not to turn around and look at Soren. The situation was uncomfortable enough without driving home the fact that he'd just been humiliated in front of a foreigner with exactly 17 minutes on the job. Yes, ma'am, Soren said. But I was wondering whether you should alert the security service about your decision to clear the sergeant. They do like to be in the loop on that kind of thing. Meow, meow, cry meow, meow, Avasarala said. That's all I heard you say. Yes, ma'am, Soren said. Bobby finally looked back and forth between them. Soren was being dressed down in front of a new team member who was also technically the enemy. His expression hadn't changed. He looked like he was humoring a demented grandmother. Avasarala made an impatient clicking sound with her teeth. Was I not clear? Have I lost the ability to speak? No, ma'am, Soren said. Bobby, can you understand me? Yes, sir. Good. Then get out of my office and do your jobs. Bobby, read. Soren, tea. Bobby turned to leave and found Soren staring at her, his face expressionless, which was, in its way, more disconcerting than a little well-justified anger would have been. As she walked past him, Avasarala said, Soren, wait. Take this to Foster and Data Services. She handed Soren what looked like a memory stick. Make sure you get it to him before he leaves for the day. Soren nodded, smiled, and took the small black wafer from her. Of course. When he and Bobby had left Avasarala's office and Soren had closed the door behind them, Bobby let out a long, whistling exhale and smiled at him. Wow, that was awkward. Sorry about, she started, but stopped when Soren held up his hand, casually dismissing her concern. It's nothing, he said. She's actually having a pretty good day. While she stood gaping and looking at him, Soren turned away from her and tossed the memory stick onto his desk, where it slid under the wrapper of a half-eaten package of cookies. He sat down and put on a headset, then began scrolling through a list of phone numbers on his desktop terminal. If he noticed her continued presence, he gave no sign. You know, Bobby said finally, I just have some stuff to read, so if you're busy, I could take that thing to the data services guy. I mean, if you're busy with other stuff. Soren finally looked at her quizzically. Why would I need you to do that? Well, Bobby said, glancing at the time on her terminal, it's pretty close to 1800 local, and I don't know what time you guys usually close up shop, so I just thought, don't worry about it. The thing is, my whole job is making her, he jerked his head toward the closed doorway, calm and happy. With her, everything's top priority. And so, nothing is, you know? I'll do it when it needs doing. Until then, the bitch can bark a little if it makes her feel happy. Bobby felt a cool rush of surprise. No, not surprise. Shock. You just called her a bitch? What would you call her, right? Soren said with a disarming grin. Or was it mocking? Was this all a joke to him? Avasarala and Bobby and the monster on Ganymede too? An image popped into her head of snatching the smug little assistant out of his chair and snapping him into a zigzag shape. Her hands flexed involuntarily. Instead, she said, Madam Secretary seemed to think it was pretty important. Soren turned to look at her again. Don't worry about it, Bobby. Seriously, I know how to do my job. She stood for a long moment. Solid copy on that, she said. Bobby was yanked from a dead sleep by sudden blaring music. She lurched upright in an unfamiliar bed in a nearly pitch-black room. The only light she could see was a faint, pulsing, pearly glow from her hand terminal all the way across the room. The music suddenly stopped sounding like an atonal cacophony and became the song she'd selected as the audio alarm for incoming phone calls when she went to bed. Someone was calling. She cursed them in three languages and tried to crawl across the bed toward the terminal. The edge of the bed came unexpectedly and plunged her face first toward the floor, her half-asleep body not compensating for Earth's heavier gravity. She managed to avoid breaking her head open at the cost of a pair of jammed fingers on her right hand. Cursing even louder, she continued her trek across the floor to the still glowing terminal. When she finally reached it, she opened the connection and said, If someone isn't dead, someone will be. Bobby, the person on the other end said. It took Bobby's fuzzy head a moment to place the voice. Soren. She glanced at the time on her terminal and saw that it was 0411. She wondered if he was calling to drunkenly upbraid her or apologize. It certainly wouldn't be the strangest thing that had happened over the last 24 hours. Bobby realized he was still talking and put the speaker back up to her ear. Is expecting you soonest, so get down here, Soren said. Can you repeat that? He started speaking slowly, as though to a dim child. The boss wants you to come to the office, okay? Bobby looked at the time again. Right now? No, Soren said. Tomorrow at the normal time. She just wanted me to call at 4 a.m. to make sure you were coming. The flash of anger helped wake her up. Bobby stopped gritting her teeth long enough to say, Tell her I'll be right there. She fumbled her way to a wall and then along it to a panel which lit up at her touch. A second touch brought up the room's lights. Avasarala had gotten her a small, furnished apartment within walking distance of the office. It wasn't much bigger than a cheap rent hole on Ceres. One large room that doubled as living space and bedroom, a smaller room with a shower and toilet, and an even smaller room that pretended to be a kitchen. Bobby's duffel lay slumped in the corner, a few items pulled out of it, but mostly still packed. She'd stayed up till 1 a.m. reading and hadn't bothered to do anything after that but brush her teeth and then collapse into the bed that pulled down from the ceiling. As she stood surveying the room and trying to wake up, Bobby had a sudden moment of total clarity. It was as though a pair of dark glasses she hadn't even known she was wearing were snatched away, leaving her blinking in the light. Here she was, climbing out of bed after 3 hours of sleep to meet with one of the most powerful women in the solar system. And all she cared about was that she hadn't gotten her quarters shipshape and that she really wanted to beat one of her co-workers to death with his brass pen set. Oh, and she was a career Marine who'd taken a job working with her government's current worst enemy because someone in naval intelligence had been mean to her. And not least of all,
She wanted to get back to Ganymede and kill someone without having the foggiest idea who that someone might be. The abrupt and crystal-clear vision of how far off the tracks her life seemed to have fallen lasted for a few seconds, and then the fog and sleep deprivation returned, leaving her with only the disquieting feeling that she'd forgotten to do something important. She dressed in the prior day's uniform and rinsed her mouth out, then headed out the door. Avasarala's modest office was packed with people. Bobby recognized at least three civilians from her first meeting there on Earth. One of them was the moon-faced man who she'd later learned was Sadavir Ehrenreich, Avasarala's boss and possibly the second most powerful man on Earth. The pair were in an intense conversation when she came in, and Avasarala didn't see her. Bobby spotted a small clump of people in military uniforms and drifted in their direction until she saw that they were generals and admirals and changed course. She wound up next to Sarin, the only other person in the room standing alone. He didn't even give her a glance, but something about the way he held himself seemed to radiate that disquieting charm, powerful and insincere. It struck Bobby that Sarin was the kind of man she might take to bed if she was drunk enough, but she'd never trust him to watch her back in a fight. On second thought, no, she'd never be drunk enough. Draper! Avasarala called out in a loud voice, having finally noticed her arrival. Yes, ma'am, Bobby said, taking a step forward as everyone in the room stopped talking to look at her. You're my liaison, Avasarala said, the bags under her eyes so pronounced they looked less like fatigue and more like an undiagnosed medical condition. So fucking liaise. Call your people. What happened? The situation around Ganymede has just turned into the shitstorm to end all shitstorms, she said. We're in a shooting war. Chapter 21 Prax. Prax knelt, his arms zip-tied securely behind him. His shoulders ached. It hurt to hold his head up, and it hurt to let it sink down. Amos lay face down on the floor. Prax thought he was dead until he saw the zip ties holding his arms behind his back. The non-lethal round their kidnappers had fired into the back of the mechanic's head had left an enormous blue and black lump there. Most of the others, Holden, some of the Pinkwater mercenaries, even Naomi, were in positions much like his own, but not all. 4 years before, they'd had a moth infestation. A containment study had failed, and inch-long, gray-brown Miller moths had run riot in his dome. They'd built a heat trap. A few dabs of generated pheromones on a heat-resistant fiber swatch under the big, long-wave, full-spectrum lighting units. The moths came too close, and the heat killed them. The smell of small bodies burning had fouled the air for days, and the scent was exactly like that of the cauterizing drill their abductors were using on the injured Pinkwater man. A swirl of white smoke rose from the formed plastic office table on which he was laid out.
I'm just, the Pinkwater man said through his sedation haze. You just go ahead. Finish that without me. I'll be over. Another bleeder. One of their abductors said. She was a thick-featured woman with a mole under her left eye and blood-slicked rubber gloves. Right there. Check, got it, said the man with the drill, pressing the metal tip back down into the patient's open belly wound.
The sharp tapping sound of electrical discharge, and another small plume of white smoke rising from the wound. Amos rolled over suddenly. His nose a bloody ruin, his face covered in gore.
I might be wrong about this, Captain, he said, the words fighting out past the bulbous mess of his nose. But I don't think these fellas are station security.
The room Prax had found himself in when the hood had been lifted had nothing to do with the usual atmosphere of law enforcement. It looked like an old office, the kind a safety inspector or a shipping clerk might have used in the ancient days before the Cascade had started. A long desk with a built-in surface terminal, a few recessed lights shining up on the ceiling, a dead plant, Sansevieria trifasciata, with long, green-brown leaves turning to dark slime. The gray-armored guards, or soldiers, or whatever they were, had been very methodical and efficient. Prisoners were all along one wall, bound at the ankles and wrists. Their hand terminals, weapons, and personal effects were stowed along the opposite wall, with two guards set to do nothing but make sure no one touched them. The armor they'd stripped off Holden and Amos was in a pile on the floor next to their guns. Then, the pair that Prax thought of as the medical team had started working, caring for the most desperately wounded first. They hadn't had time yet to go on to anybody else.
"Any idea who we're dealing with here?"
Wendell asked under his breath.
"Not OPA," Holden said.
"That leaves a pretty large number of suspects," the Pinkwater captain said. "Is there somebody you've pissed off I should know about?"
Holden's eyes took on a pained expression, and he made a motion as close to a shrug as he could manage, given the circumstances.
"There's kind of a list," he said.
"Another bleeder here," the woman said.
"Check,"
the drill man said. Tap, smoke, the smell of burning flesh.
"No offense meant, Captain Holden," Weldon said, "but I'm starting to wish I'd just shot you when I had the chance."
"None taken,"
Holden replied with a nod. Four of the soldiers came back into the room. They were all squat, earther types. One, a dark-skinned man with a fringe of gray hair and an air of command, was sub-vocalizing madly. His gaze passed over the prisoners, seeing them without seeing them, like they were boxes. When his eyes were on Prax, the man nodded, but not at him.
"Are they stable?"
the dark-skinned man asked the medical team.
"If I had the choice," the woman said, "I wouldn't move this one."
"If you didn't?"
"He'll probably make it. Keep the high G to a minimum until I can get him to a real medical bay."
"Excuse me," Holden said. "Can someone please tell me what the hell's going on?"
He might as well have been asking the walls.
"We've got 10 minutes, the dark-skinned man said.
"Transport ship?"
"Not yet, the secure facility."
"Splendid," the woman said sourly.
"Because if you want to ask us any questions," Holden said, "we should start by getting everybody off Ganymede. If you want your people to still be people, we have to go. That lab we were in had the protomolecule."
"I want them moved two at a time,"
the dark-skinned man said.
"Yes, sir," the woman replied.
"Are you listening to me?" Holden shouted. "The protomolecule is loose on this station."
"They're not listening to us, Jim," Naomi said.
"Ferguson, Mott," the dark-skinned man said, "report."
The room was silent as someone somewhere reported in.
"My daughter's missing," Prax said. "That ship took my daughter."
They weren't listening to him either. He hadn't expected them to. With the exception of Holden and his crew, no one had. The dark-skinned man hunched forward, his expression profoundly focused. Prax felt the hair on the back of his neck rise. A premonition.
"Repeat that,"
the dark-skinned man said, and then a moment later,
"We're firing? Who's we?"
Someone answered. The medical team and the weapons guards had their eyes on the commander, too. Their faces were poker blank.
"Understood. Alpha team, new orders. Get to the port and secure a transport ship. Use of force is authorized. Repeat that. Use of force is authorized."
Sergeant Chernov, I need you to cut the prisoner's leg restraints.
One of the guards did a double take.
All of them, sir?
All of them. And we're going to need a gurney for this gentleman.
What's going on, sir?
The sergeant asked, his voice strained by confusion and fear.
What's going on is I'm giving you an order,
the dark-skinned man said, striding fast out the door.
Now go!
Prax felt the knife slash as a rough vibration against his ankles. He hadn't realized his feet were numb until the burning pins and needles sensation brought tears to his eyes. Standing, hurt. In the distance, something boomed like an empty freight container dropped from a great height. The sergeant cut Amos's legs free from their bonds and moved on to Naomi. One guard still stood by the supplies. The medical team was sealing the gutshot man's belly closed with a sweet-smelling gel. The sergeant bent over. The glance between Holden and Amos was the only warning Prax had. As casually as a man heading for the restroom, Holden started walking toward the door.
Hey!
The weapons guard said, lifting a rifle the size of his arm. Holden looked up innocently, all eyes upon him, while behind him, Amos brought his knee up into the sergeant's head. Prax yelped with surprise, and the gun swung toward him. He tried to raise his hands, but they were still tied behind him. Wendell stepped forward, put a foot against the medical woman's hip, and pushed her into the guard's line of fire. Naomi was kneeling on the sergeant's neck. His face was purple. Holden kicked the drill-wielding man in the back of the knee at the same moment that Amos tackled the man with the rifle. The cauterizing drill sparked against the floor with a sound like a finger tapping against glass. Paula had the sergeant's knife in her hands, backing up against one of her compatriots, sawing at the zip line around his wrists. The rifleman swung his elbow, and Amos's breath went out in a whoosh. Holden dropped onto the male half of the medical team, pinning the man's arms with his knees. Amos did something Prax couldn't see, and the rifleman grunted and folded over. Paula got through the Pinkwater man's zip tie just as the medical woman scooped up the rifle. The freed man pulled the pistol from the fallen sergeant's holster and leaned forward, pressing the barrel to the medical woman's temple as she swung the rifle up a quarter second too late. Everyone froze. The medical woman smiled. Checkmate, she said, and lowered the rifle to the floor. It had all taken no more than 10 seconds. Naomi took the knife, quickly, methodically slicing through the wrist bindings while Holden followed along behind, disabling the communication webs in the gray, unmarked armor and zip-tying their hands and feet. A perfect inversion of the previous situation. Prax, rubbing the feeling back into his fingers, had the absurd image of the dark-skinned man coming back in and barking orders to him. Another boom came, another huge, resonating container being dropped and sounding out like a drum.
I just want you to know how much I appreciate the way you looked after my people,
Wendell told the pair who made up the medical team. The woman suggested something obscene and unpleasant, but she smiled while she did it.
Wendell, Holden said, rummaging in the box of their belongings and then tossing a card key to the Pinkwater leader. The somnambulist is still yours, but you need to get to her now and get the hell out of here.
Preaching to the choir, Wendell said. Get that gurney. We're not leaving him behind now, and we've got to get out of here before reinforcements come.
Yes, sir,
Paula said. Wendell turned to Holden.
It was interesting meeting you, Captain. Let's not do this again.
Holden nodded, but didn't stop putting his armor back on to shake hands. Amos did the same, then distributed their confiscated weapons and items back to them. Holden checked the magazine on his gun, and then left through the same door the dark-skinned man had used, Amos and Naomi on his heels. Prax had to trot to catch up. Another detonation came.
this one not so distant. Prax thought he felt the ice shake under him, but it might have been his imagination. What's going on?
The protomolecule's breaking out, Holden said, tossing a hand terminal to Naomi. The infection's taking hold.
I don't think that's what's happening, Cabin, Amos said.
With a grimace, he grabbed his nose with his right hand and yanked it away from his face. When he let go, it looked mostly straight. He blew a bloody-colored plug of snot out of each nostril, then took a deep breath.
That's better.
Alex, Naomi said into her handset. Alex, tell me this link is still up. Talk to me. Her voice was shaking. Another boom, this one louder than anything Prax had ever heard. The shaking wasn't imagined now. It threw Prax to the ground. The air had a strange smell, like overheated iron. The station lights flickered and went dark. The pale blue emergency evacuation LEDs came on. A low-pressure klaxon was sounding, its tritone blat designed to carry through thin and thinning air. When Holden spoke, he sounded almost contemplative.
Or they might be bombarding the station.
Ganymede Station was one of the first permanent human toeholds in the outer planets. It had been built with the long term in mind, not only in its own architecture, but also in how it would fit with the grand human expansion out into the darkness at the edge of the solar system. The possibility of catastrophe was in its DNA, and had been from the beginning. It had been the safest station in the Jovian system. Just the name had once brought to mind images of newborn babies and domes filled with food crops, but the months since the mirrors fell had corroded it. Pressure doors meant to isolate atmosphere loss had been wedged open when local hydraulics had failed. Emergency supplies had been used up and not replaced. Anything of value that could be turned into food or passage on the black market had been stolen and sold. The social infrastructure of Ganymede was already in its slow, inevitable collapse. The worst of the worst-case plans hadn't envisioned this. Prax stood in the arching common space where Nicola and he had gone on their first date. They'd eaten together at a little dulceria, drinking coffee and flirting. He could still remember the shape of her face and the heart-stopping thrill he'd felt when she took his hand. The ice where the dulceria had been was a fractured chaos. A dozen passages intersected here, and people were streaming through them, trying to get to the port or else deep enough into the moon that the ice would shield them, or someplace they could tell themselves was safe. The only home he'd really known was falling apart around him. Thousands of people were going to die in the next few hours. Prax knew that, and part of him was horrified by it. But May had been on that ship, so she wasn't one of them. He still had to rescue her, just not from this. It made it bearable. Alex says it's hot out there, Naomi said as the four of them trotted through the ruins. Really hot. He's not going to be able to make it to the port.
There's the other landing pad, Prax said. We could go there.
That's the plan, Holden said. Give Alex the coordinates for the science base.
Yes, sir,
Naomi said at the same moment Amos, raising a hand like a kid in a schoolroom, said,
The one with the protomolecule?
It's the only secret landing pad I've got, Holden said.
Yeah, all right.
When Holden turned to Prax, his face was gray with strain and fear.
Okay, Prax, you're the local. Our armor is vacuum-rated, but we'll need environment suits for you and Naomi. We're about to run through hell, and not all of it's going to be pressurized. I don't have time to take a wrong turn or look for something twice. Your point. Can you handle it?
Yes, Prax said. Finding the emergency environment suits was easy. They were common enough to have essentially no resale value and stowed at brightly colored emergency stations.
All the supplies in the main halls and corridors were already stripped, but ducking down a narrow side corridor that linked to the less popular complex where